Every story told has a story of its own.
She said the words, I won't forget it. What more do you want from me?
It was on the fly decision making. It was drinking water from a fire hose at that point.
Every now and then, someone at a place like the grocery store might say something like, I'm glad you're holding MPS accountable. That keeps my fire burning.
Bringing you the story behind the story. This is Reporter's Notebook. Now, here's your host, Adam Roberts.
Welcome to Reporter's Notebook, where we explore stories in the news as told by the reporters in the field, while also examining stories that merit closer inspection. I'm Adam Roberts. Thanks again for joining me here on the show today. Coming up, could a best-use study recommend the demolition of the UWM Panther Arena and Miller High Life Theater in downtown Milwaukee? That's what first came to light this past Tuesday in reporting from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Tom Dakin. We'll talk with Tom about what the study is, when it will be released, and what the future could look like for a highly visible plot of land on West Kilbourne Avenue. Also, last summer, a reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal was let go from their job following the publication of an article sent through an artificial intelligence program containing several factual inaccuracies. We explore the lessons to be learned from the situation with longtime journalist and instructor for the esteemed Poynter Institute, Al Tompkins. But first, I wanted to quickly revisit some interesting developments in the race for Wisconsin governor. Early in the week, the Democratic field grew by one, former State Representative Brett Halsey, who announced his candidacy on Wednesday. This is the second time Halsey has run for the state's highest political office, having previously campaigned in 2014, during which he was notably lambasted for a failed political stunt where he dressed as a Confederate soldier, threatening to hand out Ku Klux Klan hoods to attendees at the state GOP convention that year in Milwaukee. This stunt was captured in part by Channel 12 reporter Kent Wainscott at the time.
Eventually, Halsey admitted it was all a ploy to get attention.
Did you ever intend to hand out the hoods?
It was strictly to get you here.
This time around, Halsey has promised to run on a platform of changing school funding mechanisms to avoid over-reliance on school referenda. Another Democratic candidate already in the race had an interesting take on the school referenda issue. American Family Field beer vendor Ryan Sternad, running as a Democrat, was interviewed by WMTV in Madison's Vanessa Keldson this week and had this to say.
You say quality education at all levels. What does that mean to you?
Money needs to go into school systems. We could think out of the box here. How about selling alcohol at high school sporting events? I think, one, it would be rude to the kids, unfortunately, who aren't old enough to drink, to see adults drinking. And we also have to be careful on some liabilities. I know it's a bold decision to make, but hey, that's revenue.
Under state law, alcohol cannot be possessed on school grounds, so it remains to be seen how Sternad would plan to rework the law to allow for both consumption and purchase in the stands. And then on Friday, Republican candidate Bill Berrien officially dropped out of the race, citing the fallout of what he called salacious reporting by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Dan Bice that revealed Berrien, an outspoken critic of allowing transgender athletes in girls' sports, had followed sexually explicit accounts, including that of a transgender porn star. By the way, the 2026 election, still over a year away. Big business happenings in downtown Milwaukee, potentially. Depends on what a study suggests. Where have we heard this before? It seems like every time there's a big business rumor swirling around downtown Milwaukee specifically, it's tied back to a case study or some sort of look around from a business firm suggesting what could be done with a piece of property. And specifically, this property is owned by the Wisconsin Center District. It's what's currently occupied by the Panther Arena, the Mecca, the Arena, whatever you refer to it as, and the Miller High Life Theater, also known as the Milwaukee Auditorium, depending who you ask. What could the future hold for those two venues, as well as the plot of land that those two venues lie on? For more on this, we bring in the guy who broke the story on Tuesday. He's a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Tom Dakin, veteran of the industry, with me on Reporter's Notebook. Tom, welcome in.
Thank you for having me.
So, Tom, before we get into the story itself, you are a first-timer on Reporter's Notebook here, so I like to ask everyone who comes on the show for the first time to give a little background on yourself. How did you come to be where you are at today?
Well, I cover commercial development as a business reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel JS Online. I've been doing that since the Journal Sentinel actually was created as a newspaper in 1995. Your older listeners will recall that was the merger of the Milwaukee Journal and the Milwaukee Sentinel. I worked at the Milwaukee Sentinel for a couple of years prior to that. I started there in late 91. And from the beginning, I was kind of covering development at the Sentinel. I was a general assignment reporter a couple days a week, but then I also covered the Redevelopment Authority, the Housing Authority, and the Plan Commission for the City of Milwaukee. In 1994, I became a full-time business reporter and started doing that a little more in earnest and then continued that at the Merge newspaper. So I've been doing this for quite a while now.
So with 3 decades now in the bank, what would you say is the biggest difference between how you report business now versus how you did in the early to mid-90s?
Oh, well, it's the internet.
Of course.
Infinitely. On one hand, of course, the internet has hurt our profession in journalism to a great extent in terms of removing a lot of our ability to sell ads, which used to be our main form of revenue. Now we rely more on subscribers. Mm-hmm. But it also has conversely made my job a lot easier. Back in the 90s, if I wanted to know how much a building sold for, I would call the Deputy Register of Deeds over at the Milwaukee County Courthouse, Paul Micah, a very nice man, and Paul would look that deed up for me and tell me. If I called, say, the Waukesha County Register of Deeds, I might get somebody who wasn't so kind who would say, well, you have to come out to Waukesha County if you want to look that information up. And now all that is online every day, along with building permit applications and other things that people like me use to find news.
You'll be happy to know that that spirit still exists in Waukesha County. When I have to get criminal complaints, I have to go out to the Waukesha County Courthouse and get those in person. Yep. So the spirit lives on in that regard. So on to the story now that you first broke on Tuesday regarding this plot of downtown Milwaukee, just north of the new Baird Center as part of the Wisconsin Center District land ownership plot. So let's talk a little bit about what the story is in essence first.
Well, the story is concerning the potential redevelopment of the site. It's about 6 acres. It's about 2 blocks that holds both the UW-Milwaukee Panther Arena, where their basketball, men's basketball team plays, where the Milwaukee Admirals plays, Wave indoor soccer team, as well as the Miller High Life Theater, where some of your audience may go to concerts there. The Wisconsin Center District, which operates both those two facilities as well as the Baird Center that you noted earlier, wants to create a master plan to get a better sense going forward as to how they want to use that real estate specifically. Is what currently is there, is that the highest and best use for that site? That's part of what the master plan will look at. Coupled with that, the Wisconsin Center District is also going to put together a long-term projection of the maintenance costs going out 20, 25 years for both of those facilities. And that way you will have for the members of the board of the district a sense of here's what could happen there potentially. Here's how much it would cost to maintain the status quo. This study is to be presented to the board in January. Mm-hmm. And I suspect it will make some recommendations, perhaps suggestions as to doing things differently there than what we currently have on that plot of land.
So this story, as I was going through your reporting on it, you mentioned that the CEO of the district, Marty Brooks, mentioned some of this at first back at the board meeting in May on the 16th, I believe.
Yes.
So now here we sit in September and you've published your story. Explain to me why now? Why publish the story now?
Well, for one thing, I didn't go to the May board meeting.
Fair enough.
You know, reporters, we sometimes miss public meetings where news happens. And this is a case where, although in my defense, there weren't any journalists there. When I first heard about this, I got a tip from someone. I immediately did a Google search because I know I hadn't reported on it. I couldn't recall if any of our competitors had. And sure enough, nothing popped up. And at any rate, I did go to the proceedings of that meeting that's on the Wisconsin Center District YouTube channel, looked through it and saw what Mr. Brooks said. And then coincidentally, just last week, we had a board committee meeting, which was done in preparation for the next board meeting. And Mr. Brooks kind of did a little bit of a brief update to one of the aspects of what he discussed in May. So it was, in that sense, somewhat timely.
Sure.
In terms of reporting to our readers this week.
So this firm that's doing this study, Hunden Partners, they're out of Chicago, and they've done studies on Milwaukee plots, specifically downtown before, correct, in the Deer District?
Yes. Yes, they have. And it's interesting. If you go to their website, you'll see they kind of focus on a niche of sports facilities, kind of multi-use entertainment districts, which that's the Deer District. That's Fiserv Forum right there, right? as well as hotels. And I suspect, we have no way of knowing until January when the study is to be presented to the Wisconsin Center District Board, I would suspect one of the recommendations might include perhaps this is a good spot for the long-sought additional convention center-oriented hotel for downtown Milwaukee. Now, the rationale behind pursuing that project is right now the Center District is probably missing out on some business opportunities because it doesn't have another convention center-style hotel other than you've obviously got the Hyatt that connects mm-hmm. to it. You've got the Hilton that connects to it. There can be some argument to made that you should have a third hotel that would help land those bigger conventions. Now, that argument is countered by others who say, you know, we've got plenty of rooms downtown. Some of those hotels still need help recovering from the pandemic, and do we really want to do this, particularly if it involves any kind of public subsidy?
Most notably, Marcus Corporation Correct. Has been at the forefront of those conversations.
Yes. Greg Marcus, the chief executive officer of Marcus Corporation, has long cautioned against any kind of publicly subsidized hotel. His company, of course, owns the Hilton as well as the St. Kate Arts Hotel and the Pfister Hotel, and he has made that position quite clear over the time. And incidentally, Mr. Marcus does sit on the board of the Wisconsin Center District.
We're talking with business reporter Tom Dakin from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on Reporter's Notebook about possible development at the site that currently holds UWM Panther Arena and the Miller High Life Theater north of the Baird Center in downtown Milwaukee. Now, Tom, before the break, we were talking about this proliferance of hotels downtown. It's been a conversation in the business world and in business reporting for many, many years. I have noticed, following along since the pandemic, it really seems to have spiked up again. Where do we sit as far as hotel development in downtown Milwaukee? I know during the RNC there was all this talk of, are we going to have enough hotels to put people in? Seems like we got through those waters okay. What does the outlook look like going forward?
Well, we actually have two construction proposals that have received city approval, both from the same developer. It's the developer that's behind the Trade Hotel, which just opened a few years ago in the Deer District. And they plan to be in construction in 2026 on both the Moxie, which will be the hotel built next to the new concert venue, which is just south of Fiserv Forum. And they also plan to begin construction in, I think, June of next year mm-hmm. on the hotel down the Third Ward, where right. they're going to take that building that used to be a Restoration Hardware, or still is a Restoration Hardware, RH Outlet, and offices up above and convert that into a hotel. It's interesting. The hotels that get built tend to be around that size. You know, you're talking maybe you'll get a 100-room hotel here, 150-room hotel there. What the advocates for doing a convention center-style hotel has said, we need a different type of hotel. We need something that's large, that has those big banquet facilities, meeting room facilities, and that has a direct, if not a direct, skywalk connection to the Baird Center, at least being essentially across the street from the Baird Center.
I was going to say that's something that I would expect as well, just anecdotally, given that there are two hotels that already connect to the center right, via skywalk. Right. It would be reasonable to assume they'd want to continue that and have basically an artery of hotel skywalks.
Right. I could see that happening. And one thing about the timing of all this is happening now in part because the main tenants at the arena would be the UWM for their men's basketball team and the Admirals. They have leases, mm-hmm. and those leases for the Admirals, the lease expires, I believe, I think we said in 27, at the
Correct.
End of the 27th season. And what Marty Brooks told the board in May was, look, we want to make sure as we negotiate extending that lease, that we're not locked into something that goes long term. Mm-hmm. He made it very clear he didn't want something that was going to go out, say, 10 years. And the update on that was last week when he spoke to the district board committee, and he said, well, we're working on a lease that extends it to July of 2029. That, not coincidentally, is when UWM's lease expires and when their naming rights agreement expires. So I guess what this gets at is that the timing of this could be in 2029, we see leases expire, buildings become available for new uses, and a redevelopment possibly proceeding. Again, getting ahead of ourselves based on what the study says in January,
sure.
and then also based on what the decision makers decide to do with that information.
In your reporting, I noted that President of the Admirals John Greenberg did not comment, or actually declined to comment,
yes,
on the story. Do you think that was because John likes to talk? We've had him on shows before.
Yes.
Do you think that has to do with this just being an ongoing lease negotiating situation?
I suspect it's something like that. Similarly, the Wave didn't get back to me, and the Wave is currently negotiating an extension. Their lease just expired at the end of their last season, which I think was in April. Mm-hmm. So that's going on now. One institution that did respond, and it was after our initial story published, was UWM.
Right.
And Amanda Braun, the athletic director, made it very clear she is not pleased with the prospect, mm-hmm, of not being able to remain at the arena going forward. She feels like that's been a very good addition to their athletic program and does not want to lose that.
I can understand that, because the alternative is for the Panthers men basketball team to go back to the Klotschke Center and,
right,
play games there, which they've said in the past is fine if you want to pack it for a playoff game, perhaps, but they would prefer to be in a larger arena-style venue for,
right,
a number of reasons.
Right, right. I think part of it is it perhaps impresses recruits a little more if you can show them a legitimately fairly sized downtown arena that at one time, that's where the Milwaukee Bucks played, right?
Especially if you're D1,
right,
competing with everyone, right, else, including your neighbors to the southwest at Marquette, who play at Fiserv.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, they're a Division I athletic program. And also, I think it's viewed as perhaps a little more central for UWM alumni to come downtown as opposed to going to the east side campus, to the Klotschke Center.
The Admirals' angle in all of this interests me, Tom, because a lot of people who have talked to us here at WTMJ since you broke this story were just suggesting, well, the Badgers play hockey at Fiserv a couple times a year. They clearly can build ice, even if it wasn't designed for a hockey arena like the Bradley Center was.
Mm-hmm.
Just move them a couple blocks north. But I think those people, as we've suggested to them, will find that is much easier said than done. And I don't know if Fiserv is... and the Bucks are interested in bringing in yet another tenant when they already have two high profiles.
Yeah, and if that had been the case, then the Admirals would have been included in the original plan,
right,
when Fiserv Forum was built. And we wrote stories back then about how, okay, the Admirals aren't going to Fiserv Forum, and then they ended up going to the arena.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very conscious decision by the Milwaukee Bucks to not include them. I'm believing that their organization could earn more revenue by using that event for concerts and other special events when it's not being used by the Bucks and by the Marquette University men's basketball team.
And they certainly do hold their fair share of concerts there.
They sure do, yes.
With a neighboring venue popping up as we speak right now also.
Yeah. So if all this rolls forward and John Greenberg's fears are realized that he essentially does have to start looking for a new home a few years down the road, it'll be interesting to see what emerges as some options. I know off the top of my head, digging back in my cubby, my memories, I believe the Admirals, when they started out, were at Wilson Park at the,
wow,
ice arena there,
right,
which is a pretty small venue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we do have other ice centers in the Milwaukee area, but it'll be interesting to see how this shakes out.
Absolutely. Tom, before I let you go, I did want to comment on, I saw on X, I believe it was, when you posted a link to your story, a lot of people came in and had some thoughts. And what I appreciate about you as a reporter is that you do take the time to at least acknowledge for readers and subscribers and followers when they respond to your work. You say, even just a cursory, hey, thanks for the feedback.
Yeah,
I know there were a couple,
yeah,
in particular. That's something I don't often see, and I recognize that.
Well, I appreciate that, and honestly, I'm in an easy position. I'm writing about commercial development. I'm not writing about, you know, the latest travails in politics. So,
sure.
So the people who respond are usually relatively small in number and are thankfully civil in their responses.
But it is interesting because people have a lot of opinions still on politics, but also on business development, because,
yes,
everyone wants to see their city grow.
Sure,
but
sure,
we also want it to be done responsibly. And I know that just anecdotally, downtown always gets a lot of attention. Whenever there's something new, flashy, or potentially being demolished, it's going to get a lot of reaction.
Yeah, yeah. Well, downtown is it's a kind of place that you may not work here, you may not live here, but chances are you're going to visit here at least once in a while, maybe a couple times a year, but maybe more than that, depending on, are you a Bucks fan? Are you a Golden Eagles fan? Are you an Admirals fan? They have a very good following, including some of my colleagues who are very passionate about the Admirals, and I'm sure they're all very interested in this story going forward.
Business reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Tom Dakin, with me on Reporter's Notebook. Tom, thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you.
A topic we've brought up before on the show is AI and its use responsibly in newsrooms. One of the constant strains for every reporter is the reality of working on deadline. The truth is, newsrooms are constantly facing outside pressure, and sometimes internal, to get news out to listeners, readers, and viewers as quickly as they can. Tale as old as time. But how does the advent of AI and its ability to assist reporters in eliminating some of the more time-consuming portions of their job factor into reporting on deadline? And where should the line be drawn regarding its usage? We're bringing this up now because of a story that was published in the publication Isthmus a few weeks ago regarding the story of a reporter in Madison who was let go from her job in July following the publishing of an article on a proposed redevelopment plot in the city. The draft for the article was run through a company-installed AI program on her work computer and then published, and contained several factual inaccuracies, including a fictitious business owner and made-up information about the development proposal. A journalist had cited increased exhaustion from working on tight deadline attributed to the effects of chronic insomnia. But let's bring it back now to the responsible use of AI and how it could have been used educationally to avoid the situation. For more on this, we're joined by author, teacher, and longtime veteran of the journalism industry, Al Tompkins, with us on Reporter's Notebook. Al, welcome in.
Hi.
So, Al, before we get started, walk me through a little bit of your background. I just mentioned that you've been a veteran of the industry for 50 years plus now. How did you get to where you are today?
Well, I started on radio, like a lot of old journalists. Started on radio a long time ago and then worked in television and ran an investigative unit for quite a long time. And as many do late in their career, I began teaching, but I still write a lot and report some. And, I do the best I can to try to help journalists to figure out how to do their job better.
So that brings up an interesting point, because you've seen and done just about everything there is in our industry, and you've also seen the advent of so much new technology over that mm-hmm. time.
I started in the film days.
Mm. I can vaguely remember still going through some old film reels at my first radio job about 15 years ago, right when we were phasing completely out of using that technology and going all into wide orbit and everything digital. So I got like a little tiny little smack roll.
But remember this, and this is something I think your listeners will resonate with, and that is the technology doesn't matter as much as the truth. Mm-hmm. And the case that you cite, for example, the technology wasn't the problem. The problem was it wasn't right. Mm-hmm. And so, look, I don't care whether you use the telephone or use the internet or use email or IM or any other way. At the end of the day, your job is to get it right. And the tools that you use are just tools. And whether I'm using a film camera or a videotape camera or a camera that uses a memory chip or no chip at all, the fact of the matter is my job is to get it right. And that's the problem. The problem isn't the technology. The problem is the story was wrong. And that hurts everybody. It doesn't just hurt that journalist. And it doesn't just hurt a publication. It hurts everybody, because we all get painted with the same brush. In many ways, when people start doubting what they see on television, they also start doubting what they hear on the radio. And if they hear something on the radio that's not true, then they start doubting all journalists. We all get painted with the same brush. It's the same with doctors. It's the same with, you know, airplane pilots and you name it, right? When somebody does something stupid, everybody gets painted by it.
Is the AI discussion just a newer version of how newsrooms handled the proliferation of the internet 30 years ago, or once social media really came to be about 15, 20 years ago?
You know, it might be, but this is a little different too.
So what makes it so different?
Well, partly because it's so indiscernible, right? So I can create things with artificial intelligence that sound right, sound real, but aren't. And so my concern is that we are becoming a society of cynics, as opposed to skeptics. Now, you and I both want people to be skeptical. We want people to seek truth. We want people to say, now, wait a minute, is that right? But cynics don't believe anything. And then it becomes dangerous because then no amount of truth is enough. And my concern is that if people continuously get misled and lied to, that they won't believe anything. And so they'll just retreat back to their corner and believe what they always believe, regardless of the truth. That's the most troubling.
We're talking with author, Professor Al Tompkins on Reporter's Notebook. And Al, as part of what you do now, you educate, whether it's journalists, news directors, editors, on best practices. What have your conversations been like with those in leadership positions when they come to you and ask you, there's this new technology, it cuts down on a lot of the clutter in our job, but we can't over-rely on it. What do you tell them?
Well, the main message that I would give them is you're always responsible for what you report, period, right? They have to trust that there's going to be somebody behind this who's going to stand responsible for it. So number one, there has to be humans somewhere involved with this before it goes in front of the public. I can't just feed this into a machine and expect for the machine to somehow stand responsible for the results. So, but again, I would say the same thing about, you know, imagine the automotive industry or your dry cleaner, right? They're all using technology, but in the end, somebody's got to stand good for the car coming out the factory and saying, this is good. There has to be some inspection that happens at the end of it. But for sure, technology in our business, in the news business, is extraordinarily helpful. It helps me to get quick understandings of complex things sometimes. It helps me to sort through massive databases to try to find things that I wouldn't be able to find if I was searching by hand. It helps me to match photographs. It helps me to do all sorts of things that I might not be able to do if I have to do it by hand. So the technology can be helpful, just as it's helpful for many other professions. I'm seeing, for example, that the medical profession is increasingly using AI, for example, to identify cancer cells or to help think through, you know, what are the results of this test? What do they actually mean? And so on. So the technology is incredible and getting more so all the time. And like all technology, the ethics of the use of technology almost always moves slower than the technology itself.
Regarding the story that precipitated this whole conversation with the reporter who had been on deadline and turned in the report after using AI that was a part of their work computer program, that report still did have to go through an editor and other channels before it was ultimately published. And in a blog piece, the reporter in question suggested that they had submitted the article to their editor and it was up online within 10 minutes. Does that seem like a little bit of a too quick on the trigger decision from the editor in your regard?
It's impossible for me to know that because we don't know how much conversation happened prior to hitting publication, right? So if this was, if you and I had a lot of conversation, we talked about a story on nonstop, you know, for days at a time. And then you got the finished polished piece that looked exactly like what we had been talking about all along, then it probably isn't going to take as much fact-checking and close editing as it would if it was cold to you and, you know, you needed to comb through every sentence. And the other thing that happens in a process, and trust me, I've done this enough, is that sometimes editors have had enough background knowledge about a subject that it looks right. And there might be a number or something that just slides in front of them because it looks right. I remember, I'll give you an example, just an example of a personal failure one time. So I was writing, I think it was the first draft of a book. And for some reason, I had it in my head, and I don't know why, the number 12. So I said something about the Supreme Court, and I wrote a sentence, something about the 12 justices of the Supreme Court. And to me, it looked right. Because I was thinking 12 jurors, you know, in a jury case. And so I wrote 12 justices, and my editor wrote back and said, hey, come on, there's 9 justices. And I thought, that's the dumbest thing. I can't believe I wrote 12. So it's one of those things where it looks right, it sounds right. There's probably something in there that makes it look and sound right. But it's one of those, thank goodness you've got an editor whose head is on and they're actually thinking through it. But editors can miss things too, no doubt about it.
You do bring up an interesting point. I know that when I started out in my first market that wasn't where I had grown up, one of my first responsibilities that my boss at the time had told me was, go learn about the area, walk around the streets, mm-hmm. look for monuments, look for mm-hmm. specific places of interest. And it really can go a long way in getting those little details, right? Because as you mentioned, an editor may be in a market for 30, 40 years. A lot of reporters, if it's their first gig especially, they've only been in that spot for a limited amount of time.
Well, not only that, but sometimes you're editing stuff about things you've had no personal experience with at all. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you were, imagine you were, a network editor and you're editing a story about, you know, some hurricane damage in some part of Florida, you have no idea, you've never been there. I mean, you know, sometimes you're editing for facts, things that you have not personally experienced at all. And frankly, there's not a lot of research that you can lean on to know whether that's true because something occurred that hadn't occurred before. So there is no historical background for it. So, you know, in some ways you have to rely on whoever's in the field, whoever's reporting, but you can ask them all sorts of questions. My favorite question, and this is a question your listeners can ask anytime they hear a news story, how do they know that? Who said that? You know, attribution is such an important part of journalism.
Agreed.
Do they have eyes on it or did they just hear it? And it's one of the things that I think that as journalists, we don't pay enough attention to, and that is telling people how we know what we know and what we're doing to find out what we don't know. Journalists way too often don't cite specific sources. And we also give way too much license to our sources not to be directly identified, particularly government sources, particularly in government agencies where they're afraid for their jobs and so on. It's happening so much right now during this Trump administration where people are scared to death to talk. And so we get so many unnamed sources that undercuts my ability to understand how you know what you know, and so therefore undercuts your journalistic credibility.
But still, definitely, before I let you go, it's just a reminder that put the work in, go the extra mile, and as I like to say, show your work. It can't hurt you at all.
You know, I hope that listeners can come out of a conversation like this with sort of a mental checklist as they listen to stories that are important to them to say, did they tell me how they know what they know? Did they tell me whether they have eyes on this or whether they have any personal experience? What did they do to fact check this? And hold the information accountable. At the same time, and this is something I say to audiences all the time, we're all responsible for what we say and what we pass along and what we comment on, what we share in social media. And I think all of us underestimate how much we influence others. You know, there's somebody listening or watching or reading what you say or write or do, and you probably don't even know that you're influencing other people. But the fact is, when you share something, when you comment online, somebody is being influenced by what you say, and each of us has a personal responsibility there.
Author, journalist, teacher, he's Al Tompkins, and he's with us on Reporter's Notebook. Great stuff, Al. Thanks so much.
Great talking to you.